Page number 20, 1107 FM. Clean Fuels Alliance America Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Len for the petitioner, Ms. Kimball for the respondent, Ms. Dawson for the interveners.
Good morning. David Lane for petitioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Len? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you right. Len? Lane?
It's Lane, but I'll respond to either one.
Oh, no, no. I actually want to honor you by getting right. So, Lane. Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please. May it please the court. In the 2020 RFS rulemaking, EPA considered the issue of what to do about retroactive exemptions when establishing annual RFS standards. EPA determined that henceforth, when setting standards for a particular year, it would adjust the standards to account for the exemptions granted retroactively for that year, but not adjust the standards to account for exemptions granted retroactively for prior years. EPA codified this policy in the regulation that defines the formula for computing standards. The logic of this court's precedents and EPA's own statements imply that this policy is unlawful because it compels EPA to violate its core mandate of setting standards that are reasonably designed to ensure that the national volume requirements are eventually met, and because it compels EPA to engage in arbitrary decision-making by setting standards that it knows ex ante will be ineffectual. This court has said in the Reset case, Sinclair, and others, that if EPA does not adjust renewable fuel obligations to account for exemptions, it creates a renewable fuel shortfall and impedes attainment of overall applicable volumes. Our claim is that EPA is legally required to make those adjustments, including for past retroactive exemptions. I'd like to just be clear about how our claim works. There are really two different scenarios in which adjustment to the standards is needed for past retroactive exemptions.
Before we get into the merits, what is the final agency action that you are asking us to review?
The 2022 rule. In which
2022.
Sorry, excuse me. The 2020. I misspoke. The 2020 rule.
I think that might have been a Freudian slip.
I hope it was not. But definitely the 2020 rule. That is the in that rule, EPA reaffirmed and readopted its policy of not making up past retroactive exemptions after revisiting the issue, and that is. That is itself a rule within a rule. It's a statement of generally applicable policy that governs.
What aspect of the 2020 rule has a legal effect on you today as we sit here that imposes a right or an obligation?
So every time EPA sets RFS standards, it is operating according to the policy that we're challenging, which precludes it from accounting for past retroactive exemptions. And by doing that, it...
But the policy didn't come from the 2020 rule. The policy that impacts you today is a policy that was adopted in whatever rule is operative today, which is not the 2020 rule.
I don't think that's correct. The policy stands independent of the standards that were adopted in 2020. So EPA took a policy position. That's a statement of generally applicable policy that will govern in the future. And then in that same rulemaking, it applied that to set percentage standards for that year, 2020.
Policy that, isn't a final agency action.
It is because it's a rule. Under the APA, I mean, this is standard administrative law, a statement of generally applicable policy is a rule, and that is an agency action, and it governs. And we litigated this in the 2019 rulemaking context in the Grove Energy case, and the court considered what it called the direct challenge to the policy of not making adjustments for retroactive exemptions. And the court said at that point, it was time barred because EPA had not reopened the issue. But in the 2020 rulemaking, EPA reopened the issue, revisited it in response to an administrative petition that we filed for reconsideration of the policy, and EPA determined to maintain its policy with respect to past retroactive exemptions, but it changed its position.
Best language in that rule, in the 2020 rule, where they made a full-blown adoption of policy as opposed to a declination to do what a petition for reconsideration asks?
I'm sorry, I don't think I quite followed the
question. What is the best language? Like, normally when they adopt a policy, they say things like, and you want this to be this forward-going policy.
Mm-hmm.
Although it started in 2019 and you didn't call, I mean, if it started in 2019 and you were time barred on challenging it, then I don't know why you get to do it now. So, but your view is that they made some comprehensive announced policy that would govern not just 2020, but all years going forward. And so I'm just hoping you can point me to the language where they did that.
Yes. So I would start at JA36. And at JA36, this is in the 2020 rule. The history is that in the context of the 2019 rulemaking, this is the growth energy case, we challenged this policy. The court rejected it on the grounds that EPA had not reopened the policy in that rule during that rulemaking and had actually established it back in 2012. But in the 2020 rulemaking, EPA revisited the whole policy. They did it in response to our petition for reconsideration of the policy. So at JA36, EPA describes our petition.
Okay, which column are you in on JA36?
The middle column.
Okay.
And footnote 154 cites our petition for reconsideration. And in that petition for reconsideration, we argued that EPA had...
But where's the text, language in the text? Is it the... carryover paragraph at the top, the full middle paragraph, the carryover. What language do you want me to point me to for them adopting a cross-cutting policy that's still continuing to govern today?
Yeah. So first of all, look at footnote 154 at the bottom of the column.
Oh, I see citations there to a reconsideration petition. So
that's our reconsideration petition.
That. Where's the announcement of the policy?
Okay, so then if you go up, the language is. So in the middle, the first full paragraph right in the middle of the page says, we are finalizing these changes and in turn also completing the process of revisiting this issue that we undertook as described above in response to the above noted administrative petition.
Sorry, that, very confused.
It's right in the middle of the middle paragraph.
The paragraph that begins in the October 28th proposal?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is talking about our petition, which asked EPA to revisit this policy of not accounting for retroactive exemptions. And EPA says it's completing the process of revisiting the issue. To complete that process, it has to account for what we asked for in that petition.
The above noted administrative petition?
Yes, that's the one that's cited in 154.
But was that the only administrative petition before them in 2020?
I mean, it's referring to the...
Because usually they call a petition for reconsideration. It's different than an initial petition for action.
Well, that is what it's referring to. And that was our petition for reconsideration of this policy. Then EPA...
Okay, but anyhow.
So EPA then says...
Not your issue.
It is our issue. The issue we presented in that petition for reconsideration was whether to account for retroactive exemptions, both past and projected. And
okay,
in this,
they are definitely addressing your projected ones.
Yes, but
they talk lots about that. They give reasons for it.
Yes, but they can't complete the process of revisiting the issue raised in our petition without addressing the issue of past retroactive exemptions, because that's what our petition was about.
What do we do with the? I'm sorry, please finish.
And then they say, I would point you to, if you bear with me for 1 second, I have more quotations on this.
It seems like they're talking there about the thing that you wanted about the changing the denominator, getting the prospective exemptions factored in. That's 99.9% of what's going on here.
Well, that's what they decided to do, and they're rejecting the rest of what we wanted. And so they are reaffirming their policy of not making the additional adjustments for the past retroactive exemptions. I'd also point you to JA117 in the response to comments. That's the 2022 rule.
That's the problem that I've got, because in the 2022 rule, they say... We are reaffirming the modification of the percentage standards formulas for the 2020 final rule to account for FCE, the projection thing.
Yeah.
And then they say, we have chosen not, this is, they actually say it in words here.
Yes.
As opposed to just silence.
Yes.
In 2020, they actually say it in words. And they have 3.5 pages of analysis in 2022. We have chosen not to reallocate exempt volume from SREs for past years. That's your second position, the one you're challenging now.
But yes.
Number two.
Correct.
In 2020. Whether through revisions to the percentage standard formulas or otherwise. This action constitutes our final and complete response to that petition.
Yes. So you omitted the first sentence of that, which is we are reaffirming our response to that petition.
I understand.
That is,
you can add that. That's fine.
But that
this action constitutes our final and complete response to that petition.
Yes, because
this is where they answered your arguments for 3.5 pages. If anything is an adoption of a policy, I mean, just declining to do something is not a policy. That's cross-cutting, forward-looking policy. To the extent they did anything, they just decided in 2020, we're not going to do the there's some retroactivity already, the big retroactivity that's that you want.
So
in 2022, because there's just no analysis.
And I ask you to look at,
if I'm just finished my point, and then you can do this. And then in 2022, we get 3.5 pages of analysis, textual, programmatic. I mean, all the things that we expect to see when they are making a concrete determination that will carry forward until otherwise changed. And they announce that that is the final and complete response to the petition you're referencing. And so I'm really having trouble understanding how the 2020 decision was a policy for anything other than the 2020 rulemaking, given what they did in 2022.
Okay, I'd like to make a few points. Mm-hmm. The first is at JA80. This is in the response to comments from the 2020 rulemaking. They say, we are not modifying the percentage standards to account for past retroactive exemptions. They're talking about the issue that we're presenting here. It's a JA80 mm-hmm. response to comments.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that...
Okay, they just say we're not doing something. Is it every time an agency says we're not doing something in this rulemaking, that's a policy that's governing for the next 6, 7
years? No, not necessarily, but it's against, in the context of what's going on. There is a policy of not making adjustments for any retroactive exemptions before 2020. That's the pre-existing policy. No accounting for any retroactive exemptions. It is a rule that governs all rulemakings. It's not that EPA adopts it every time it conducts annual standards. If it did, we would not have lost in the growth energy case. There would have been no reopener issue because EPA would have just automatically had to redo the policy every time. But what the court recognized was that this is a freestanding policy that governs year over year. It applies generally in perpetuity. We lost that case because EPA had not reopened. In 2020, in response to our petition to reconsider that policy, EPA revisited the issues presented in the policy. That's what it's explaining in the middle column at JA36. And it says, although in the 2020 rulemaking, the passage you quoted where the EPA says this represents our complete and final.
That's a 2022.
Okay. 2022 disposition of the petition. It said the same thing earlier. It's fun because it revisited the issue all over again. But in the 2020 rule, it said this, we are completing the process of revisiting this issue that we undertook in response to the administrative petition.
But this issue is doing a lot of work there. Didn't say these issues, plural. Your petition had multiple things it wanted. Most importantly, account for projected exemptions. That was, I think, your big thing. You really were. That was maybe the other was different, but anyhow, that was.
I don't know which was bigger. They were
okay,
but they were both central.
They said this issue and this issue. All they're talking about on that page is the forward projection. They didn't say these issues. This issue. And that's this issue is what everything they talk about on that page, which is forward projections.
Well,
so it's, I mean, I get that they didn't do the second thing you asked for. I get that. And so that's an implicit denial.
They didn't do it, but they didn't do it in the context of revisiting. This completes their process of revisiting the petition. The petition was about this issue. They can't complete a process of revisiting the issue presented by the petition without revisiting the part that we're challenging here and rejecting it. And that rejection comes more explicitly at JA 80.
There's no doubt that you could argue, you could challenge that denial. There's no doubt that you could at the time. But then we have in 2022, what I think is arguably, wouldn't have to decide it definitively, but a serious reopening and reconsideration of this issue, where I think for the first time, tell me if I'm wrong, they devote multiple pages in their response to comments to the very precise issue you're raising here about the prior year adjustments.
They do discuss it more extensively in the 2022 rule, but
more extensively, by hundreds of percentages, more extensively. And they say, this is our final resolution of that reconsideration petition.
They said the same.
That would be a good argument, and that would be a great argument that 2022 sounds like a conclusive judgment based on a record with explanations of agency balancing policies and considerations, looking at the statutory text. That would be a good argument for we are locked and loaded for the going forward until we completely revisit this and explain the change in position. But in 2020, because there's nothing other than implicit denial that we're not going to do that. Here's how we're adjusting it. This is one of the things they wanted. This is the issue we're dealing with. So implicit denial of that. That seems like a very good argument that they denied it in 2020, but that was for the 2020 rule.
It certainly was not for the 2020 rule.
What's your definition of a policy? What's the legal test for knowing when something is a policy that's going to govern over many, many rules, unless and until the agency formally changes its position, from a decision not to act on a particular reconsideration petition?
First of all, the 2020 rule is the denial of our reconsideration petition as well. So, there's no other document that says we deny your petition or we have acted on your petition.
The
2020 rule.
Well, there's another document. That's exactly what they say.
But the 2020 rule says we are completing the process of revisiting the issue in the administrative petition. This is the end of the process. The EPA decided to do it again in 2022. That was their prerogative.
So that was my point about the issue or this issue.
I just think that it's not artfully worded. They're talking about our whole reconsideration petition. And they're resolving the reconsideration petition. And it is a policy.
Okay,
it is a policy because this is the position that governs all standards. In the growth energy case, we would not have lost on the reopener doctrine and the time bar if it were just a one-off year-by-year decision. Otherwise, it would have been timely because we filed within that 60 days of the 2019 rule. But the court said, no, this was a policy adopted in 2012 at the latest. And it continues. It operates every year that EPA sets standards. And so you had to challenge
it
in 60 days.
It was adopted and locked in 2012 or 2019. And if you're untimely in 2019, how can you possibly be timely in 2020? Unless you're saying every individual rule is another adoption of the policy.
No, because they explicitly say they're revisiting the issue in the context of the 2020 rule in response to a petition for reconsideration. So they have reopened it. They've reopened the policy for reconsideration.
What factors do we normally look at to find that something's been reopened?
You look at the entire rulemaking context. I think there's
of
a case
you
from
do that, but
2013, there's a case called Center for Biological Diversity that explains how you do this. You look at NPRM, response to comments, everything the agency says, final rule. And here we have a discussion of there was a policy in place. We are revisiting the policy in response to your petition. Your petition asked for two things. We're giving you the projection, but not the makeup of past or not dealing with past retroactive exemptions. We elaborate on it at JA 80, where we say that explicitly that we're not adjusting the percentage standards to account the formula. It's talking about the formula for computing percentage standards. And this is all embodied in the regulation at 40 CFR 80.1405C. That regulation specifies the formula for computing computing percentage standards. In 2020, not in 2022, in 2020, EPA modified that formula to include an adjustment for projected exemptions. And it did not modify the formula for, but it couldn't, if you're not going to account for it, the only way to modify it would be to insert a variable times zero, which would not have made any mathematical sense. So by preserving that part of the formula, that reflects their decision to maintain this as the policy after revisiting it in response to the petition. So they reopened it and they reaffirmed the policy. And then they did it again in 2022. But it doesn't matter they did it in 2022 because the Union for Concerned Scientists case and the American Maritime case established that if you have a challenge to a first rule and a later rule reaffirms the position, even if your challenge applies equally to both, the later rule doesn't moot the challenge to the first rule, and that's the posture we're in.
The interveners cite Alaska v. I guess it's Alaska v. EPA. Alaska v. U.S. Department of Agriculture for the proposition that once a rule has been superseded, a challenge to it has become moot because you challenged the new rule that superseded it, and Alaska relies on lots of cases, including a case called Akiachak. But I didn't see any response to Alaska or that entire line of cases in your reply brief.
We respond to it. I don't think we cited the Alaska case, but our response in that brief and my response here today is that the 2022 rule did not, the case law says that when an agency withdraws or rescinds or modifies the earlier rule, the challenge to that becomes moot. That didn't happen here. The position that was adopted in the 2020 rule is exactly the same as the position adopted in the 2022 rule and is the same as the position that EPA has today. It has not changed. It has never been withdrawn. The 2022 rule never purported to withdraw or supersede the 2020 rule. All it purported to do was use a different power, the reset power, to modify a different aspect of the 2020 rule, namely the percentage standards that had been set for 2020. That's the only thing it changed. Otherwise, it left it completely intact, and it used the word reaffirm over and over again. And the Union of Concerned Scientists case and the American Maritime case are more specific about this situation than the Alaska case. The fact that you have a later rule that reaffirms an earlier rule and you have a challenge that applies equally to both does not moot the original challenge, unlike where the later rule withdraws or modifies the earlier rule. That does moot it, but that's not the context that we're in.
Counsel, can I ask maybe a simplified version of this to make sure I'm understanding? You would if your argument was in 2020, it was an arbitrary and capricious argument that they didn't sufficiently explain themselves, and then they gave a new explanation in 2022 for the same result, but it's an entirely different, more expanded explanation. You would agree your arbitrary and capricious claim would be moot, right? It would make no sense.
That would make sense to me.
Okay. But your claim in this case is the statute requires them to account for past exemptions. In 2020, they said no. So I think we all agree you could file a petition right then saying not accounting for past exemptions is contrary to the statute. And in your view, all that happened in 2022 is, sure, they gave more explanation, but they still said, we're not doing what you want. And you're still saying that's contrary to the statute.
That's correct.
And that's what motor and equipment says. You can amend, you can do whatever else, but if the regulation that you initially challenged is still the same.
That's exactly correct. Okay. And otherwise it would turn into a kind of whack-a-mole game. EPA issues these rules every year. Every year, while one challenge is pending, they could say, oh, we're going to reaffirm that policy in this later one and kill our lawsuit. And then we have to go chase them in the next lawsuit. And then they can do it again in the next rule. I mean, during the 20-
What is a little bit confusing here is the relief. So What do you actually envision happening? Is it that the next time we're not going to go back and recalculate the 2020 obligation?
Correct.
Is it that you want them to amend the formula and the regulation, and you think, I guess, the next year is going to be 2027, that when they do that, they have to account for every past exemption in setting the new standards?
That is basically right. The way I would frame it is I would say that you could partially vacate the 2020 rule, vacate it to the extent that it readopts the policy of not accounting for past retroactive exemptions, send it back to EPA. EPA has to reformulate its policy, probably involves amending the standard equation in the regulation, and then that would govern future rulemakings. No one is saying EPA, no one wants EPA or is asking EPA to go back and change the 2020 standards or the 2022 standards or any past standards. This is about changing how EPA operates in the future. So it would have to apply this new policy, this amended policy, starting with 2026, which is going on now. Or if it didn't complete this remand process in time, it might be the 2028 year that it begins to implement this correction. But it would be going forward.
Your brief doesn't ask for vacatur. Your opening brief, reply brief, just asks for remand.
Well, that might have just been...
Reply brief said the same thing. I didn't see vacatur in any of your briefs.
Okay, well, I mean, I think you can do...
A footnote going, maybe not. A footnote in the middle of the brief, but in both cases, you did not ask for vacatur. So you want them us to remand the 2020 rule.
I think you could remand without vacatur, given the fact that, you know, we don't need to knock out a lot of parts of the rule. We're not asking you to invalidate it entirely. So you could remand without vacatur, or you could just vacate in part.
To gut the formula that they adopted. It's a huge part of the 2020 rule. You got the denominator wrong because you didn't account for the prior years as well as prospective. That's not ordinarily a remand.
Yeah. I mean, we're not ordinarily a remand without vacatur.
Yes, you want what they did, their formula,
yes,
thrown out as legally wrong, as contrary to statute.
Yes, that's right.
When have we ever done that and just remanded?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think we were trying to give the court flexibility in how it dealt with this, because it is an odd.
You can give us flexibility by saying, you know, you could do this. We ask that you first vacate.
Yes.
In the alternative, remand without vacatur, but you didn't do that. You only asked for them to go back and think about it a little bit more.
Okay. Well, I think our intention was, if vacatur makes more sense, to do the vacate. And if I can ask for it right now, then that's what I'll do. I mean, I think that partial vacatur, we're not saying you have to vacate the entire rule. And I think that's maybe where some of the unclarity came from in the briefing, because we're not trying to suggest
computational formula.
Potentially. I mean, EPA might solve the problem in a different way from changing the formula.
Is your whole, was that your argument to them in 2020? Or was it that, no, your formula needs to account for both projected and backwards? Did you give them an alternative?
I mean, in our reconsideration petition, I think we gave them alternatives. And in our comment, I think we also gave them alternatives.
What were the alternatives?
Well, EPA could fix it in the, it could basically add the amount to the numerator.
That's changing the formula.
I mean, they are in the, certainly this is embodied in the formula. But again, EPA could just say,
change the formula.
From now on, we're going to,
ways.
Maybe this is semantics, but EPA could have a policy that says, we're going to account for this in the future by, when we compute the numerator, we're just going to add this amount to that numerator. We're not going to change the regulation, but this is how we're going to implement
2020
it.
Formula was wrong.
Effectively, yes. Yes.
Effectively or yes?
Yes, because it embodies the policy that we're challenging.
So in answering the question of whether the statutory text compels this prior year accounting for which you're advocating and have advocated. If we decide that as part of the 2020 challenge you have here, we can't go beyond the 2020 record, right? That's how we, we look at the statute.
That's,
did they say anything of relevance? And as we've discussed already, not that I see.
I think that's correct, but I also don't think it matters, because our argument is about the interpretation of the statute and the application of this court's precedent, and that's all you need.
Well, I think so. The 2020 rule has some very considered agency analysis, both of the text and how it operates and programmatic implications of this. And Loper-Bright's quite clear that Skidmore deference remains and that we can consider if it would be helpful and persuasive in a particularly complicated statute like this that involves a very intricate formula. We can consider the agency's expert views, its consideration, and its perspective. We ultimately decide what the statute means, but we can consider it. And so why would it make any sense to decide that question on the 2020 rule record, as you just said, that lacks all that considered explanation and analysis, if we would come to a different answer, if we ask that same question in 2022 or whatever year from the 2022 rule, will we have that? And if that we could accord Skidmore deference to the agency's views. There's two different statutory interpretation questions before us, 2020 and 2022. So the answer for 2020 and exclude everything they said in 2022, I think that only answers the question for 2020.
Well,
if it would be a different answer, let's just assume, and I know you would argue that it's not.
I don't think it can be, because this is...
But if it, let's assume that in reviewing the statutory language as to whether they are compelled in their formula, their fractional formula, to include prior years, if it would make a difference to the statutory interpretation question. I'm not saying it would, but if it would, don't we have to decide that based on the 2020 record, where 2022 record, where we have that input from the agency?
So even, I think the answer is no. And even in the old Chevron deference world, the answer was no, because this is a pure question of legal interpretation and application of precedent. And we cited the Sierra Club case in our brief.
Well, pure interpretation and application of precedent are not, I'm sure what you're saying here, because our precedent on this issue predated Loper-Bright, other than we just had the Sinclair decisions, one of which is post.
It did predate Loper-Bright, but it wasn't, it did not, the relevant parts of that precedent didn't rest on Chevron deference. It rested on the court's interpretation of the statute. So it's still valid.
Clear. My question is, and I'm not saying this is how it would come out, if we would have a different answer on the 2022 record because of Skidmore, Loper-Bright's best Skidmore, than we would in 2020, what are we supposed to do?
Well, I think that because this is really a legal question, whatever, I mean,
if we would have a different answer to that legal question.
Yeah.
If we decided, reviewed it on the 2022 record with agency input subject to Skidmore consideration, than we would in 2020 in the absence of that explanation. What are we
then saying? You should consider the arguments that EPA presented in 2022, which it, I think it repeated.
To decide this based on the 2020 record.
It repeated those arguments in its briefing here. And we have no objection to those arguments being in the briefing. We're not saying.
You told me that we have to consider it on the 2020 record.
Yeah,
if we're going to consider, if we're going to consider on the 2022 record, it seems very odd. Then, because we would, if it makes a difference, we would say it was plain statutory construction permitted by law in 2022, but not 2020.
But these are legal arguments, and all the arguments that EPA makes are in its brief in this case. And you can consider the all agency, the legal arguments. No. You're not bound by legal arguments made outside the record. You can consider all legal arguments.
Just give more deferences to the agency's expertise, not their attorneys.
Which they've expressed time and again in prior rulemakings, which are all before the court, which they've expressed in their brief, which are before the court. Everything EPA wants to say on the subject, it has said to the court outside of the 2022 rulemaking. In any event, because it's a purely legal question, I don't see why you couldn't look at strictly speaking, you look at the 2020 rulemaking, correct, but because it's legal, I don't see why you can't look at any arguments EPA is making about this. It's not, we're not making
all rulemakings going forward and backwards for their input on this.
I don't see a problem with that, because this is a legal question that we're presenting. And so the court needs to come up with the best answer, and it can look at whatever it wants to look at for the best answer. Even if we, you know, in this rulemaking, if EPA hadn't articulated something and it puts it in its brief, that's still for the court to consider because it has to get the best reading of the statute, not the best reading with one eye closed and ignoring a bunch of other stuff, but the best reading. And there's plenty of evidence what's for to use for Skidmore weight, although, again, I think this court's precedent and the logic of what EPA has already said determine the outcome of the merits of this case without without any kind of deference toward EPA's position.
Colleagues, do you have other questions?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one question about, you know, the merits.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about the merits.
So you rely on the word insurer. The immediate question is, insure what? And it seems to me that one basic way of thinking about the question is it year by year or is it cumulative? In other words, and then when you look at the table, which is what just ensure the requirements of the table are met, it seems to me that your position would make sense if just starting at the top, it's a 2000 by 2007, 8.7 billion. But instead it says 4 in 2006, 4.7 in 2007. Just seems quite clearly to envision a year by year target, not a every year you have to look back and make up for prior undercompliance. So just wanted to hear your brief articulation of where that requirement comes from.
I'll try to be brief, but I want to make a threshold point about this, which is that there's really two scenarios in which past retroactive exemptions create a problem. And I think what you're talking about is kind of true up scenario where, you know, there's shortfalls in the past.
And the second is the banking, but which is.
Yeah. So that, I think that is the second scenario. The first scenario to me is there are the exemptions inflate the RIN bank and that inflation persists and will persist into the future rule that's or a year that's being set. There wasn't a past shortfall yet. There's just these extra RINs because of the exemptions. And so in that scenario, you're not trying to true up across past shortfalls. What you're doing is you're saying the standards we're setting for the future will not actually require the amount that we're specifying because those RINs are going to be available and they will suppress the binding force of the requirements. This is actually the logic that justified the projection makeup that this court approved in the reset case. It's also the logic that's in EPA's recent supplemental NPRM for the set 2 rulemaking. So that's one scenario, and it doesn't even generate the problem that you're pointing to. The other scenario which does generate this problem is if those exemptions created an actual shortfall in the past year because either the fuel was never used or it was used and then that inflation of the bank was already drawn down to avoid compliance in an intervening year, then you'd have a shortfall in the past. And so where do we get this idea that you get to kind of sum up those shortfalls and add them to the future? Well, I understand your point about the text, but this court in the reset case most recently said that the insured duty includes increasing future year standards to ensure that volumes that should have been used in the past will eventually be used. It said that in the context of discussing the makeup of the 2016 waiver, which was, you know, was added on to the 22 and 23 requirements. But there is this idea that there's sort of an obligation over the arc of the program to bring it into line with that gradually increasing set of requirements. And
I think what we saw is that EPA has authority to do that.
You did say that.
It has to do that.
So the question that was presented was about authority because it was challenging what EPA did. But of course, what the court has said over and over, including in the reset case, in the Winningwood case, in the American Fuel case, and others, is that this is the insurer duty is EPA's core mandate. It is a requirement. And what reset does is it distinguishes between that mandate and what it, and some discretion in the implementation. So the reset case says the statute doesn't confine EPA to a particular method of accounting for exemptions. In other words, you have to make it up somehow, but how you do it you've got some discretion. Maybe you spread it over years. Maybe you put it in the numerator. Maybe you put it in the denominator. Maybe you use projection. Maybe you only do retrospective makeup. You know, the projection is just one part of this, and it's optional. EPA could have done it in other ways. So I think the authorization part is a combination of the question that was being framed or the way the case was being framed and the fact that it was really a challenge to the particular method that EPA was using to account for these exemptions. And broadly, there's a lot of time shifting in the program, carryover RINs, carry forward deficits. They're all poke holes in the idea that these are hermetically sealed years and reinforce that this is really a program that stretches over the entire span of the program. And that's what EPA needs to ensure.
Following up on Judge Garcia's question in, that same provision, I guess, 02A, Romanet 1, the phrase about promulgating regulations to ensure, in both the first sentence of that paragraph, it talks about no later than 1 year after August 8, 2005. It says you are to ensure that gasoline sold, that EPA, the administrator, is to ensure that gasoline sold or introduced into commerce in the United States. I'm going to skip language there. On an annual average basis, what work is average doing there?
I don't know if EPA has ever spoken precisely to that issue. I think it can be understood to mean exactly what we're saying, that maybe it's not a mathematical average, but actually that across the years, you know, if you're supposed to have 20 in 1 year and 25 in the next, and you do 22 in one and 23 in the next, and you combine them, then you are hitting the requirements on an average annual basis. They're all sort of netting out to equal the total amount that's supposed to be used.
It uses the same phrase on annual average basis in the second sentence, which is for regulations, you know, after December of 2007.
Correct.
But they don't have the annual average basis language later on about subsequent. But correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think that's the only in the other provisions that have the ensure language. I think those are the only two that use the phrase on an annual average basis. I don't think that that language is, I think it supports our position for the reasons I just said, but I don't think it's essential to our position. Again, in the courts recognize this sort of, you know, broad sweep of the program ensure duty on multiple occasions. The National Petrochemical case where EPA took the 2009 requirements and added it to the 2010, and the court said, yes, the insured duty means that you have to eventually make sure that the volumes are met across the years. It's just because you were late doesn't mean you abandon that year. The reset case said it again.
Right, we said you have to do it across the years. In which case?
In the reset case, the Sinclair reset case, the language, I think it's at 891 or 893. And it said, I'll read you the quote. The court deemed unpersuasive, that's a quotation, that the statute does not provide a true-up mechanism on the back end.
Sorry, I'm sorry, which column are you in and which paragraph? On 893.
So give me a moment to get the case. All Are you looking at a Westlaw version of this?
I think it's
are you in the version. Paragraph that begins with to start, we conclude?
It's the next one.
Oh. The part I just quoted is in that paragraph, and then I'm going to go further down. So in that paragraph, they say, the refinery petitioners argue the statute does not provide a true-up mechanism on the back end if things don't go as planned. That argument is unpersuasive. The next paragraph, we had made clear that EPA must ensure the applicable volumes are met regardless of delay. And then, therefore, EPA may increase later year volumes to make sure that volumes that should have been met in earlier years are eventually sold or introduced into commerce. That is the lesson of National Petrochemical.
May.
Well, that goes to what I was saying.
You said I thought you, and maybe I misheard you, I thought you said they were required by the statute too.
Well, that goes to my point earlier with Judge Garcia, that this is, that the insurer duty is a mandate. It is obligatory. The case was framed in terms of authorization because that's all that the petitioner needed to show. And what the court said was, the insurer duty is mandatory, but that doesn't confine EPA to a particular method for accounting for exemptions. So there is really, the question was, could EPA use this projection method to account for exemptions? And the court said, yes, EPA could also account for exemptions in other ways, but it has to eventually make sure that these obligations are made up. Now, in this context, it's talking specifically about making up the 2016 waiver. I just want to be clear. This passage is not about the exemption part, but I am reading, I mean, it's the insurer duty that is controlling in both of these, both parts of the decision. And I'm, you know, putting together the things the court is saying in those two sections of the opinion.
I noticed in response to Judge Wilkins' question about annual average basis that you answered it by saying average annual basis.
I think the first time that, yeah, I did say
yeah,
that.
Average annual basis would have been very helpful language for you, because that average annual basis would suggest you're averaging a basis over the years. But this does not say average annual. It says annual average. And if you think about an annual average of something, that sounds like an average within that year.
Yeah, I'm not sure that really makes sense, though, in the context of the program. I mean, what's required is an amount, not an average, right? The standards are, you have to, there's a volumetric requirement, which is the number of gallons of renewable fuel, and there's four of them. And then there are four percentage standards that everybody has to meet to generate one volume. And compliance is not determined by
how much is sold into commerce. And I think would annual average basis just be a way of saying, we're not going to require that be a pro rata January, February, March, April, May. Instead, as long as the average number over the year, that 12-month period, satisfies the required amount percent calculated as a percentile or not introduced into commerce. If that's what they mean. It's hard to know. It does seem striking that they don't say average annual. Average would sound to me a very different meaning.
It may just be more of a drafting error than anything else, because what you just proposed.
So for a plain text argument.
Our argument doesn't rest on that language.
They got it twice in here.
Our argument doesn't rest on that phrase.
Our analysis of all the relevant language suggests that there would have been a very easy way to say your point, average annual, and they didn't. I don't think it's a drafting error. It's here twice.
Well, I don't think it can mean what you just proposed, because the compliance is not determined by averaging the months. It doesn't matter what anyone does in one month or another month. What matters is what they do over the course of the year.
That's exactly what annual average means.
Well, you would just say the total.
So
why would you go to the total and then back into an average from that?
If I could
that
ask Congress every time why they said it the way they said it, I would be a nonstop job just doing that.
Well, I just think it doesn't make any practical sense to use that language to mean what you're proposing. The much simpler solution is just the amount that's used in the year.
But your response to him that it supported your view.
Yes.
Doesn't work because it doesn't say what you needed to say.
Well, I think that what I'm saying is a more sensible construction of that language because the alternatives don't make any sense to me. But I also think that the argument works regardless of that language. I don't think that language has driven any of the court's decisions on the insured duty. The court has still articulated this duty to make up over years. The court has still articulated this duty in the reset case, speaking about the projections that it helps ensure that the future standards will actually require the volumes that are being specified and required and will not create under compliance. That all comes from the insured duty. That's what we're resting on. And none of that turned on the language of annual average basis.
Any questions?
Just one last question about the breadth of the argument. So it seems like the logic is once EPA knows there was an exemption in the past year that results in a shortfall, it has to make up for it. It seems like everyone tries to disclaim that they would have to do the same thing if shortfalls happen for other reasons, like overall fuel production just ends up being lower than expected. Mm-hmm. The logic of your argument, I think, would suggest that they do have to make up for that kind of shortfall too. And is that right? And if not, why not? How do you limit your position to just these exemptions?
So a couple of things. In the Sinclair case, in the reset case, the court drew that distinction and said, we're going to require a makeup. And by the way, we're only talking about this true-up scenario where the exemptions already created a shortfall, not the prospective shortfall that doesn't generate this problem. But where there's already been a shortfall and you're going to have a true-up, the court said, in the context of the 2016 waiver analysis, it distinguished between making up for the waiver and making up for a technical error inherent in the projection of what independent third parties are going to do in terms of how much gasoline or diesel they're going to use. And the court said you don't have to make up for those errors. You do have to make up for the 2016 waiver. We would say that the exemption is like the waiver because these are programmatic actions by EPA. They're not independent actions by third parties. There's two other ways of thinking about this. The second is that the gasoline shortfall doesn't really create a shortfall. It creates a shortfall with respect to the volumetric requirement, but that volumetric requirement under the program gets operationalized as a percentage. And the gasoline shortfall does not create a shortfall relative to the percentage. The percentage still operates, whereas the exemptions create a shortfall not only with respect to the volumetric requirement, but also with respect to the percentage requirement. The percentage ends up being lower than was specified because of the exemptions.
The problem I have with that is that the reason that the percentage is off is that something was included in the denominator that shouldn't have been included in the denominator, right? Which is the amount of fuel used or introduced into commerce by the small refineries that ended up being exempted, but their production was counted towards the amount in the denominator, correct?
That is correct, but it's one way of understanding what went wrong.
Well, Sinclair Reset said that if there's an error in the projection of the denominator, that's, how things go. And, these projections can be off. The legal error that has to be corrected is an error in the numerator. That's what Sinclair Reset said. So if we look at it as an adjustment to the denominator, doesn't Sinclair Reset, maybe it doesn't doom your arbitrary capricious argument, but wouldn't it doom your statutory construction argument?
I don't think I agree with your reading of the reset case because the accounting for exemptions that EPA, for projected exemptions that EPA adopted and was approved in that case was an adjustment to the denominator. And the gasoline is also in the denominator. So the court said the insurer duty allows EPA to adjust the denominator for exemptions, and it does not require EPA to adjust the denominator for gasoline. So I don't think this is about denominator.
The Sinclair case 101 F4th at 895.
Okay.
And the paragraph that begins, the two situations are materially different.
Yes. I think what the court is talking about there is specifically about the 2016 waiver, which was a numerator problem, because it caused EPA to specify a lower total renewable fuel volume than it should have. That's the numerator.
And it says that when there's a numerator has been set too low, that is a legal mistake. And the resulting percentage standard is subject to vacature. But then they say that if the denominator is set too high, i.e. incorrectly forecasting total fuel usage, they say that that is a technical error inherent in the nature of projecting events that have yet to occur.
Yes.
So that's not, according to this case, a legal error in the sense of you have, at least the way I read that, setting the denominator too high is not a legal error in the sense of violating the statutory, the statutory mandate.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things. One is, I don't think that should be read to mean to draw a categorical line between numerators and denominators, because the projection of exemptions is done in the denominator. And the court said EPA can make that adjustment to the denominator. That's one thing. The second thing is that we can implement, EPA could implement what we're asking for through a numerator adjustment.
But my,
it could increase the volume.
But just my point is, the fact that they can adjust the denominator doesn't answer the question of whether they must. In this case, says the way I read it, that it's not a requirement, it's not a mandate, it's not something that they must do.
Well, they certainly are not required to adjust the denominator. That goes to the particular methods. Court says the statute does not confine EPA to particular methods for accounting for the exemptions. Maybe it does it in the denominator, maybe it does it in the numerator. But its core mandate, and that is a mandate, is to ensure that the volumes are met. And that includes increasing future years to make up for volumes that should have been used in past years. And that includes increasing future years where there are available RINs that result from exemptions that would cause those future requirements to not actually require the specified amount of renewable fuel. That could be done through a correction through the numerator. That's where EPA has play in the joints. And it can be done spread over multiple years. EPA has play in the joints. But there is this fundamental mandate, which all of this sits on top of. And EPA right now is simply ignoring part of that mandate.
All right. I think we're talking
past each other. I apologize, Your Honor. I was trying to answer. Thank you.
We appreciate that. We'll give you a few minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Kimmer Kimball here today on behalf of EPA. The portion of the 2020 rule petitioner's challenge here has been superseded. The sole component of the 2020 rule that petitioners attempt to tether their claim to is EPA's change to two factors in the denominator of the percentage standard formula. But EPA fully reconsidered those two factors, as well as the percentage standard formula as a whole, in the 2022 rule. Accordingly, the 2022 rule has superseded the 2020 rule, and this case should be denied as moot. This case should be dismissed as moot, or under the doctrines of waiver, forfeiture, or latches.
What's your best case for theory that, let's assume that the 2020, this policy was a policy was adopted to not go back to prior years and adjust for those. And in 2022, you look again and say, yep, we were right in 2020, not going backwards. What is your best case that what occurred in 2022 supersedes the policy adopted in 2020 so that it can no longer be challenged?
So two things. First, to your honor's point before, I don't think it's fair to say that EPA really adopted a policy in the 2020 rule of not going back to correct past year's exemptions. As your honor noted, there's nothing in the 2020 rule that discusses that whatsoever. But the best case in the fact that the formula has been superseded, I think, is the Alaska v. Department of Agriculture case that Judge Wilkins noted before.
What do you mean the formula has been superseded? The formula is the same.
But the EPA completely reopened the formula, took comment on it. It fully considered it. It fully considered petitioners' arguments that past year's exemption should be considered for the first time.
I guess here's my hangup, right? If all we had was the 2020 rule, not the 2022 rule, you still would have had a final rule that rejects their legal argument. You might have done it without any explanation, but you rejected it, and they could challenge it. And we would have before us today a pending challenge to the 2020 rule as contrary to law because it didn't account for past exemptions. And we would adjudicate that today, right? If there wasn't a 2022 rule, that would be live.
Yes.
And then for everything I just said, the 2022 rule doesn't seem to change anything about the legal question. We would still ask, is it contrary to the statute to not account for past exemptions? And that seems like the motor and equipment case. They superseded the rule in all sorts of ways, but they kept the regulation, one of the regulations that the petitioners initially challenged in place, and we said it wasn't moot.
So I think a couple of things. First, the 2022 rule fully considered additional things that were not considered in the first rule. And had this court considered the 2020 rule and found that EPA insufficiently explained what it did,
1,000% agree that any arbitrary and capricious claim would be moot. But a contrary to law claim, setting aside Judge Millett's very good point about Skidmore, has nothing to do with what you said in the record. It's a question about the statute and whether your regulation complies with it. And that, it doesn't matter what else you said in the second rulemaking.
That's a fair point, although I would also note that the 2020 rule was not considering whether or not to address the past year's exemptions. The 2020 rule was specifically considering only whether to address the projections.
But like you agreed with me that after the 2020 rule, when they file their petition for review, there is a live challenge to the legal question. Is it contrary to law not to account for past exemptions? So there was a live dispute. And then you need an argument that something about the 2022 rule moots that live dispute. And I also think you just agreed that nothing about the 2022 rule alters the legal question that was live. Is it contrary to the statute to not account for past exemptions?
That's fair. What changed was the record on which EPA considered the rule. So EPA reconsidered the formula and considered various aspects of the formula. But the thing that changed was the record on which EPA considered it with respect to.
Well, I won't belabor it, but doesn't that mean that if there were an arbitrary and capricious challenge to the extent of the reasoning, that is moot, but the contrary to law challenge is not moot because nothing has changed?
Well, I think to Judge Millett's point, the fact that there is this record could provide Skidmore deference. But I take your point that the formula did not change between the two rules. But it is also true that the 2022 rule adopted the formula anew. So if this court were to vacate the 2020 rule, there is no practical effect, because the formula is still there because of the 2022 rule. All this court could do is issue an advisory opinion that EPA should also reconsider the 2022 rule.
We can't hold that the regulation violates the statute in a way that requires you to amend your regulation going forward?
You could hold the EPA's adoption of the regulation in 2020 violated the statute, and that EPA should, I guess, consider that in deciding whether or not to reconsider the 2020-2022 rule.
Seems to me that if that is true, then all of our cases saying if there is an ongoing policy that's repeated in new regulations but not meaningfully changed, that they don't really mean anything because we must be able to grant relief. The relief, even without the 2022 rule, in this kind of a case would be totally prospective. It would be next time you do 2020 rule is set aside. We obviously can't go back to 2020 and make you do it right. But now going forward, you must comply with our interpretation of the statute. And it just seems like that could be a remedy in this case too. When you come up for 2027, you have to follow the statute.
Well, but in order to do that, well, I guess it's true that the legal question is a question that remains in every year. But EPA's full consideration of that question, I think, is something that this court should take into consideration in deciding whether or not to decide the issue. And I take that is less of an Article III mootness issue and more of just an equitable doctrines issue and more of a consideration of EPA had a better record in which it fully considered these issues in a later rulemaking. And therefore, this court should consider this question or should have considered this question in the later rulemaking. And petitioners had the opportunity to present this issue in the 2022 litigation. But instead of actually arguing this issue, they intervened on our behalf and defended the rule.
And I will yield to my colleagues, but one just small question. What does annual average basis mean?
So I agree that I don't think EPA has spoken to this issue. I do think that it's fair. So two things. First, the actual statutory basis that petitioners use is not 02A1. It's 031. And 031 doesn't speak to an annual average basis. It instead speaks to the forthcoming calendar year, which is very clearly an individual year. I think that 02A1, and this is my interpretation, but 02A1 and 031 can be read together. And the average annual basis is actually referring to the fact that EPA has to do the percentage standard formula in 03.
The annual renewable fuel percentage standard is signified in an equation that's at 40 CFR 80.1505C, right?
That sounds correct. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it sounds correct.
And so in the 2020 rulemaking, they said, okay, this is what we think that the annual renewable fuel percentage standard should be. And they set out that formula. Mm-hmm. And it's got all the symbols and all of that. And the symbols mean different things. And so the rulemaking, I guess what I'm getting at is that what the petitioners, they say that they want to set aside this policy that was articulated and announced in the 2020 rulemaking, but really the manifestation of the policy is the formula, and the formula is in a regulation. And they haven't asked us to set aside the regulation. But isn't that really what they're asking us to do? Or isn't that really the upshot if we grant them the relief that they're asking for, is that we would set aside 40 CFR 80.1405C?
I think the relief that they're requesting has been very vague and has really shifted throughout the course of this litigation. So I don't want to speak for what relief they're actually seeking, but it does seem like the only place that they've actually tethered any of their arguments to the 2020 rule is through the percentage standard formula.
Maybe rather than ask you what relief they are seeking, because that is a question better put to them. Let me ask it this way. If they come back on rebuttal and say, you're right, that is what we're seeking. What's your response to that?
My response is the same, that the 2022 rule superseded the 2020 rule and readopted that same formula. Therefore, that is the rule that would need to be challenged in order to challenge that formula. Vacating the 2020 rule with respect to the percentage standard formula does nothing to effectuate a change in the regulation.
Would that be true every time? So presumably when you did the 2025 standards, you also stood by the formula in the regulation. Does that mean that a challenge to the 2022 rule would be moot now?
Every time you set your standards,
you continue to use this policy, and if using it again moots a prior challenge.
Two things. First, the key issue here is that EPA fully reopened this question to comment on it and fully reconsidered it. Therefore, EPA in 2022 specifically was considering this formula and readopted it. But it is also true that by the very nature of the Clean Air Act's jurisdictional and venue provisions, that it is the case that any 2022 rule would be moot by 2025, because Clean Air Act very carefully channels all litigation into a single challenge to a rule, which is the problem here, because petitioners are essentially arguing that they get to challenge the same thing twice, and they don't get to do that. EPA superseded the regulation or superseded the rule with the 2022 rule, and that was their only opportunity to challenge this formula.
I feel like we may be confusing terms, because it's one thing to challenge a rulemaking, and it's another thing to challenge an agency policy. It can cross-cut and be applied again and again in different rulemakings. And so assume there was a policy adopted sub silentio in 2020 not to count for prior years. And then that, do you consider what happened in 2022 to be sort of the formal adoption of a final position on this prior year's incorporation redress issue that would continue unless until changed by the agency?
Yes, I think to the extent that EPA has adopted any policy on the prior year's issue, it could only be in the 2022 rule.
And so let's say they'd challenged it in 2022, and then, you know, litigation takes what time it takes, and as a new 25-26 rulemaking comes out, as in 2020, doesn't say boo about this issue, could they not still challenge in 25-26 the policy adopted in 2022 about prior year redress?
Not if it was not reopened. So if EPA reopened the issue in the 2025 rulemaking,
why would they have to reopen it? That policy would still, assuming the formula reflected no change, that you just said that would be the adoption of a policy, a formal agency position on that question. That's really what you guys called it in 2022. And so as long as that's still the live policy, that's going to get repeated in every rulemaking. You don't revisit every policy in every rulemaking, do you?
No, you don't.
We're going to account for estimates of exemptions we expect will be granted. You don't revisit that or reopen that in every rule, but it continues to be a practice.
It does, but
isn't that the same thing for what happened? We decided in 2022, unless and until the agency decides to revisit that question, if it ever does, that is the answer
So that is the answer. So petitioner had to challenge it in 2022. To the extent the question is, could they challenge it?
And then when that litigation drug on too long, they'd have to challenge it in 2025, 26. And then when that dragged on too long, they'd have to challenge it in 26, 27.
No, wait, I'm saying the opposite. You can only challenge it in the rule that actually addressed the issue. The fact that there is a continuing policy doesn't give you a new opportunity to challenge that issue. That's something that is more unique to the Clean Air Act, because the Clean Air Act really channels all litigation into a challenge within 60 days of the rule actually expressing that that policy, and it requires people to have submitted a comment on that issue. And for all of the channeling that the Clean Air Act does, it's very specific to, you will challenge this rule once, you will challenge it in the D.C. Circuit, if it's a nationally applicable rule. And all of that channeling is through 42 USC 7607.
Okay. And then I'm struggling with what to do here. So they say, let's assume policy adopted in 2020, that they want to challenge, because they got no explanation from the agency as to why they were not prior year adjustment. They want to say important question, error of law, both of those approaches. And then 2022, the agency says, okay, we hear you. We are looking at this again. Here is our comprehensive review and our comprehensive answer. And then you say in terms, and that is our final answer to your petition for reconsideration. Just what you say in 2022. And they go, we're all in. We're defending this rule 100%. We have, and make no objections whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But they can still go back. It just seems, I don't know, it just seems odd to me that, are you arguing they're stopped, that they're res judicata, there's something they made their decision in 2022 to endorse the rule fully? Having no doubt been fully aware of your direct response to their petition for reconsideration and declaration that that's a final answer to it. So they forfeited any challenge?
Yes.
To that reconsideration petition?
Yes. They waived or forfeited the challenge by not raising it in the Sinclair litigation. Alternatively, they're barred by latches because they waited until the Sinclair decision was upheld.
All those doctrines are a little confusing here because they did, you know, they kept their 2020 petition alive for all these years. So it doesn't look like a normal latches case. It's just, I think to an outsider, at least, it would look like you had your objection. They answered it and you said, we're all in.
Yes. I still think that the waiver and forfeiture fully apply. We also argued prudential mootness, that there's no real relief left for the court to offer, and it's an entirely different record, and the first record is stale. All of those doctrines, I think, go towards the how improper this is for judicial review, even if it is judicially available, that the court should instead stay its hand, because petitioners should not be able to do this sort of piecemeal duplicative litigation where they challenge the same thing multiple times in multiple cases. Also, for what it's worth, it's not unusual for this court to put a case into abeyance while the agency reconsiders a rule. And for that reconsideration to affect nothing in terms of ending the first litigation, even if they fully reconsider the issue, would have profound implications, I think, for just how this court operates.
Do you have a view? Your friend on the other side said, if we get to deciding the legal question that they've presented, your question of law, and we consider it on the basis of as adopted in the 2020 rule. That's what they've asked us to do. We can still consider everything you said in the 2022 reopening, I guess. You called it a reopening, right?
Right.
Reopening. If we were to invoke Skidmore, we could still consider that, even though that postdates by 2 years the 2020 rule that would be under review. Is that right?
Do I agree that you can consider EPA's analysis in the 2022 rule?
In deciding the legal, not the arbitrary capricious, the legal challenge, if we're only deciding that, I mean, if we decided in this appeal, we're deciding it based just on 2020, what was adopted by the agency in the 2020 rule.
I mean, I do think that it would be improper because another court has already considered the formula under the 2022 rule and on the record of the 2022 rule. So I think doing this sort of backwards, sort of clawing back the 2022 rule via the 2020 rule, despite the fact that it superseded the 2020 rule, I think is odd and sort of really procedurally difficult. If the court is still going to consider the legal issue, then I think, I think that the agency's statements about its reasoning are very valid to the court's consideration.
Any more questions? Do you have any more questions? All right. Okay, thank you very much. So we'll hear from the intervener now.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. Elizabeth Dawson, on behalf of the interveners, obligated parties, American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, and the small refineries. First, I'd like to start with just addressing the mootness question, and in particular, how important it is to remember that the 2022 rule, what we're calling the 2022 rule, not only superseded 2020, but also fully replaced it, because that rule covered the compliance years 2020, 2021, and 2022. So it is not just that EPA reopened and reaffirmed its legal reasoning with regard to the formula. That 2020 rule is completely replaced. As such, there is no effective relief that this court could grant that would redress any injury that occurred because of the 2020 rule.
When you say replaced, are you saying that there is a specific part of the 2020 rule that in the 2022 rule said that part is no longer effective?
Correct, Your Honor. By the time EPA promulgated the new 2020, the replacement 2020 rule, it changed the percentage standards to effectively reset them to the amount that had been produced in 2020. Because if you will recall, this was kind of a sui generis situation where we had COVID. And so EPA was reconsidering the 2020 rule in that context. So, again, focusing on this part about relief and the fact that the petitioners are effectively seeking advisory opinion, I would go back to that Alaska versus USDA case, because in that case, the court noted that it would be entirely inappropriate for the court to do as the state would want and issue an advisory opinion to guide the agricultural department's rulemaking. And that's exactly what they're seeking here. They are seeking to have EPA consider this court's opinion on the policy articulated in 2020 in these upcoming rulemakings. And as we know, EPA is now already in the midst of proposing the second version of the set rule for 2026 and 2027. So they are hoping to influence that future rulemaking instead of dealing with whatever EPA ends up with on a full and complete record in that rulemaking, in which they will have a full and fair chance to argue what they would like with regard to the meaning of the statute. But that is not appropriate for this court to consider at this time because there is no effective relief that can be had for 2020. And unless the court has any questions more about mootness, I would just turn to the merits for a moment, if I can have 1 minute. I just think should the court reach the merits, it should deny the petitions because there is no statutory authority. There is no reason to reconsider whether small refineries should have to reapply for exemptions that they were already granted in a previous year, and because it wasn't arbitrary or capricious for EPA to decide not to reallocate in the 2020 rule.
Why is it saying that small refineries are essentially losing an exemption that they got in a prior year if we were looking at this as just like a true up where the denominator, we got to the EPA got the denominator wrong in the prior year.
So petitioners are asking EPA to increase future year standards based on what they deem to be under compliance or missed volumes in previous years. That would be taking those volumes, which were lawfully exempted amounts that small refineries under the statute shall not have to comply with, and porting them over into a new year. And that would effectively, even though it would be spread out, would require small refineries to justify once again why they shouldn't have had to comply with that percentage of their obligation for the prior year. And I think this also goes to the point that the court was making about whether this is really the only true-up mechanism that petitioners are seeking with regard to small refinery exemptions versus other reasons that the volumes may not have been made. And there, for example, in Sinclair, where this court was deciding on EPA's decision to add a supplemental volume because of a legal error in 2016, that is very different from lawfully granted exemptions that EPA is by statute required to provide to small refineries that demonstrate that they qualify. That is not really a missed volume. That is a legal entitlement to a small refinery when it demonstrates that it is deserving of the exemption. So it is not the case that it would be that EPA is not ensuring that these volumes are met by not accounting for a lawful exemption granted in a prior year.
Any other questions? All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Lane, we will give you 2 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few brief points. When we filed this case, we had a valid challenge to the policy. The other side doesn't actually dispute that. They concede it. Their argument is that it became moot. But all that happened in the 2020 rule was an elaboration of the explanation for the position. And that alone cannot render our original claim moot. They don't cite any case that says that.
And they replaced the 2020 rule.
That's clearly not true. The 2020 rule itself says that all it's doing is modifying the 2020 percentage standards. That's it. Otherwise, it explicitly says it's reaffirming everything that
the percentage standards
are the application result
by the formula.
Yes, they're determined by applying the formula.
And you challenge the computational formula.
That's correct. But we're not challenged. We didn't. Our challenge here is not about the application of the formula to particular numbers or percentages. It is the formula that stands independent of how it is applied in a specific year. So that's the same policy that we challenged in the growth energy case. And the court said you have a direct challenge to the percent to the formula or the policy, and you have a challenge to the particular percentage standards that were set. Court separated the two. I said the challenge to the policy was time barred because EPA didn't reopen it. Here, EPA reopened, they revisited the issue. That's uncontested. The other side never argued reopener in their briefs. So we have a live challenge to the policy. And all they're saying is it's moot because there was an elaboration of the explanation. But Skidmore can't render cases moot just because the agency goes out and says more about the reason in a later action.
Mootness is one thing. What about waiver and forfeiture? Why didn't you raise this argument in the Sinclair reset case?
Well, the Union of Concerned Scientists, American Maritime and Motor and Equipment give us the assurance that we were under no obligation to raise it in the later case. In those cases, the court said, we're not going to require a party to have to go out and litigate in a second case.
This is the later case.
No, this is the earlier case.
No, but
this is the 2020 case.
In practical, literal sense.
Only because we agreed to an abeyance. I mean,
right.
While this case was pending, the 2022 rule came out. We never agree that our challenge here became moot because of the issuance of the 2022 case. We stood on the sidelines because we thought that the 2022 case could foreclose our claim here. If the refinery's challenge to the projection had succeeded, then we believed that would also mean we would never win our claim. In addition, at that time, EPA had announced a new exemption policy that would have wiped out all exemptions from 2018 onward. And we looked at that and thought, if this holds up, we really don't have to worry about these exemptions anymore. So there's no reason to force, the cost and, the time for us, for the court, litigate this issue. So we'll wait and see what happens. And then the exemption policy was reversed.
The rule said it was looking at your reconsideration petition and gave pages of answer and said, this, the 2022 rule, is our final answer to your reconsideration petition. And we see you coming in saying the 2022 rule, we are all in. You didn't stay on the sidelines. You were there, as I recall, intervening in support.
That's not correct. The rule. We intervened in support of the rule with respect to
the 2022 rule.
Yes, with respect to the projection.
So that makes it.
We weren't saying the whole thing was good.
You were. They gave you an answer. I mean, it's the strangest thing I've ever seen. As we say, we are really upset in 2020 about this decision on our reconsideration petition. And in 2022, they say, okay, we will think about it again. And here is our answer. Lots of explanation. And this 2022 rule is our answer to your reconsideration petition on this precise issue of what to do about prior years. And then you show up in the litigation and you don't say boo about it. You don't say we support, as parties do all the time, we support this part, but we don't support this part. It was right in this regard, but also this should have happened. You came in and you didn't say boo. It sounded, anyone looking at your brief there would have said, well, I guess they're satisfied with the answer they got to their reconsideration petition in the 2022 rule. And then lo and behold, we're like, oh no, we're still unhappy with our answer from 2020.
Well, the only issue that was presented was the projection issue, and we confined our, we weren't a petitioner. We were interveners. So we were intervening to defend. We could have, but we didn't.
Chose not to. You made a strategic decision.
Well, we had a right not to because of cases like Union of Concerned Scientists. We had a valid live case.
Union of Concerned Scientists involved them between the interim rule and the final rule, objecting to something in the interim rule and then coming in the final rule and saying, we are on board and not saying a word about their objections that they still had. Did that happen in those cases?
The case was decided before the second litigation occurred.
So
there was no occasion for it. This happened because we agreed to an advance.
This is very different.
It is different, but it's not different in the fundamental way.
You made a decision about how to respond to the 2022 rule, which incontrovertibly was EPA's answer to your reconsideration petition. And now you're asking this court to review the 2020 answer to your reconsideration petition. You spent all that time pointing to that footnote where you said they're answering our reconsideration petition.
Yes.
So you want us only to look to their 2020 answer to your reconsideration petition, but not your 2022 reconsideration petition when you had every opportunity to challenge it then and you didn't.
It's the same policy. All they did in 2022 was reaffirm the policy that we had already challenged.
You got zero explanation in 2020. I understand what your challenge would have been. And you got lots of explanation and you didn't say boo about it.
Yeah, we didn't need to. This case was preserved. It was on ice. We had a valid challenge. It was in abeyance.
It's astonishing to me that it would have been very easy to file a second petition. Because, they've now answered again our petition, and there's still no improvement.
Well,
you're putting an awful lot of hope in having this answered based on the 2020 record.
This was the first time that EPA revisited the policy and decided it. I mean, in some sense, this made more sense. This was the one that all the second one did was reaffirm.
They didn't decide. They were dealing with one particular issue. And then you must have pointed out to them that, hey, we still haven't got an answer on this. And so in 2022, they gave it to you. 2020, they were rulemaking in the middle of COVID.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that characterization. Our petition for reconsideration that was before the agency covered the past retroactive exemptions. And in the final rule, EPA said, this is our completion of the process in responding to that petition. And we are sticking by not accounting for past retroactive exemptions. And in 2020, they said, we meant it.
Hold on. You were saying that in 2020, EPA gave you your answer to your reconsideration petition.
Yes.
What what other evidence other than what's stated in this rule do you have for that? For instance, does an EPA have a docket? And don't they put an entry on the docket when they have closed or resolved a reconsideration petition?
The petition is listed on a web page. I don't believe there's anything about a decision on that listed on that page. That is, I don't think there's anything stated. I could be wrong, but I don't think there's anything stated there about a decision. But everyone, I mean, we understood and the agency understood that the 2020 rule was the decision on the petition. I do have one other piece of evidence. That,
then why did they spill three pages of ink on it in 2022?
Well, they went back. They went back to it. I mean, we're an important stakeholder in this process. The refineries are. The agency listens to what we say. There are conversations in between. They go back to the issue. I'd like to read. This is more evidence. This is from the 2022 rulemaking. JA 117. We are reaffirming our response to that petition. That's saying we decided the petition in 2020. We resolved the issues. It was the completion of our process. And now we're revisiting it once again. And we're standing by what we did in response to that petition in 2020.
And this, at the next sentence, this action constitutes our final and complete response to that petition. I'm assuming you guys saw that when the 2022 rule came out.
Yes, but
this is our final and complete response to your petition, and yet you chose not to seek review, not to petition for review.
That's
supposed to go in support and not have any qualification. If there's something in your brief from 2022 that drops a footnote saying, by the way, we're still unhappy about that, let me know. But you, as far as I can tell, you didn't say anything. You got this answer. We're looking, you're a stakeholder. We've had conversations. So we are looking at your petition again. And we are giving you all the answer that we have given in here. And yes, we're reaffirming. We've looked at it all. Mm-hmm. And we've come to the same conclusion. Agencies sometimes do that. Sometimes they change.
Yes.
But they looked at it again and told you this is a final and complete response to that petition.
Yes.
And you didn't do anything about it.
Because we had this case.
You were happy with the 2020 response, even though you just told us you had conversations, intervening conversations. You're a stakeholder. They care about your views.
We weren't happy with the response. We were litigated. We had filed a petition to review the response. We disagreed with it, and we had that case preserved. We filed it timely. It was in abeyance, and we knew we could go back, or we believed, consistent with the case law, that we could go back to that case.
So is it your position that the formula in the CFR 40 CFR section 80.1405C, that formula is wrong?
Yes, that formula embodies a policy that we say is invalid as a matter of law because it excludes any accounting for past retroactive exemptions.
So why didn't you just ask us to set aside that regulation?
I don't think there's a difference in asking you to set aside the rule or act on the rule that makes that regulation and set aside the regulation itself.
Was that particular formula first adopted in the 2020 rule, or had that formula been adopted?
So there was a formula that predated the 2020 rule. That prior version did not include any accounting for retroactive exemptions. The 2020 rule modified the formula to insert a variable for projected retroactive exemptions, but not a variable for past retroactive exemptions. And that is the formula as it exists today.
So the formula at this particular subsection, 80.1405C, was modified in 2020.
Yes, and not modified in 2022.
And not modified in 2022.
Correct.
It's history.
If we had brought this challenge in 2022.
Just follow up on that real quick.
Yeah.
It's history. The end of the rule shows that it was modified in 2022.
Not in the relevant respect. Maybe there was some other change, but not with respect to.
It doesn't show anything in 2019.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. I thought I heard you say it. They had changed it in 2019.
No, the 2020 rule modified it.
I misheard you then. Okay.
The 2020 rule modified it. The 2022 rule did not modify it. At least with respect to the exemptions, we're talking about
modification in 2020 and then 2022.
Yeah, but the 2020 rule did not modify it with respect to exemption accounting. There may have been some other. The formula does a lot of things. There may have been some other change that I don't recall, but it wasn't about exemptions. The only modification for exemptions was in 2020.
When did this formula first not include a prior year account for prior years?
For exemptions? Probably, I mean, it might go back to 2010, 2011, 2012, somewhere around there.
That's the first time it didn't do what you think it should have.
That's why we lost the growth energy case in the 2019 rulemaking case, because
you were untimely.
We were untimely. I also just to speak to the vacator point, I wanted to just mention our footnote 2 in the reply. We do ask for vacator there. I probably would formulate the language differently in retrospect, but we were asking for vacator with respect to
where? What page?
Footnote 2. It's on page, well, the relevant sentence is on page 6. The footnote starts on page 5.
Contrary to intervener's objection, the court could invalidate the challenge policy and remand the rule without vacature.
Yes.
Or it could vacate the rule. So you're like, well, you could do either one. So I look to what you're actually asking us to do, and it's remand.
Okay. Well, vacate and remand, partially vacate and remand, please.
Have you asked for a declaratory judgment? Can you get that under the EPA?
I mean, the Clean Air Act allows you to declare the action unlawful, I believe. I believe it's formulated right. Similar
but
to the
EPA. You haven't asked as a form of relief.
Honestly, I don't think I've ever seen a brief in an APA case that, or at least in these Clean Air Act cases, that does it as a distinct form of relief that's requested. Mm-hmm. If you did that, we would be happy with that outcome as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just asking the question. I'm not quite sure how they all intersect.
I'm quite a bit over. I had a couple more points, but I will questions. Recede if I right. Exhausted my.
Thank you, Reg. We have exhausted you, I'm afraid. So we're
thank
we're
you very much,
grateful.
Your Honor.
We're grateful for your help, your assistance, and assistance from the government and intervener. The case is submitted.
Thank you.